From the BYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We close out the decade with a laugh on this edition of Fresh Air with five comics. It's the final edition in our series of interviews from the Fresh Air archives. Phyllis Diller tells us how when she was starting out, she was too good-looking to make it in stand-up. Richard Lewis reports on his symptoms. Richard Belzer does Bob Dylan. Robert Townsend talks about the stereotyping he faced in Hollywood and how that led to his movie Hollywood Shuffle. And we say farewell to the Al Franken decade with Al Franken. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The United Nations General Assembly today adopted a resolution against the U.S. invasion of Panama. The resolution called it a flagrant violation of international law. The vote for the resolution was 75 in favor, 20 against, and 40 abstentions. The U.S. received support from most Western European countries. Spain, however, supported the document but said it had reservations because the resolution made no mention of the situation in Panama before the invasion. The man who led the recent Czechoslovakian revolution that toppled the communist leadership is the new president of that country. Václav Havel was formally sworn into office today during an emotional ceremony in Prague. Havel is a renowned playwright and recently was a political prisoner whose works were banned in his homeland. The latest clashes in Hong Kong between riot police and Vietnamese boat people come at a time when speculation is growing about who would be next in line for forcible repatriation. The first group was sent back to Vietnam 2 weeks ago, and the BBC's Stephen Vines reports from Hong Kong that the next group is likely to come from the detention center where the latest violence took place.
Fears over the threat of more deportations in the future are believed to be behind the resistance to the police action. Earlier in the day, police officers accompanying prison staff attempted to enter the center but were met by a hail of stones. The officers withdrew and an attempt was made to resolve the problem with the mediation of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and aid workers in the camp. However, the mediation attempt failed and in the middle of the afternoon, some 400 riot police stormed into one half of the camp and seized over 430 weapons such as iron bars and homemade knives. An hour later, they employed the same tactics to gain entry to the other half of the camp. Dozens of people were injured in the operation, including three Vietnamese who've been taken to hospital. The police have made a number of arrests and say that the situation in the camp is now under control.
Stephen Vines reporting from Hong Kong. Federal investigators are looking into a firebombing at a Planned Parenthood clinic near Kansas City this morning. Law enforcement officials say someone doused the front of the clinic with gasoline and apparently threw several Molotov cocktails through a window. Mary Jo Draper with member station KCUR reports.
No one was injured in the incident, which occurred about 3:30 this morning. Planned Parenthood officials say the fire was contained in the reception area, but that part of the building was totally destroyed. The clinic is used for family planning counseling. Abortions are not performed there. But Planned Parenthood officials say this is not the first incident at the clinic. There have been several reports of shots fired through the window and a small fire being set there. Anti-abortion activists in Kansas City say they don't think anyone connected with their movement bombed the clinic. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Jo Draper in Kansas City.
Stock prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 21 points to close at 2753.20. This is NPR. The FBI confirmed today that the NAACP has received a racist letter identical to the one sent to an Atlanta television station on Wednesday. A group mentioned in the letters is claiming responsibility for recent mail bombings in the South. In the letters, the group says it could continue its violence against federal judges and civil rights activists. Meanwhile, a Maryland state judge who was injured when a mail bomb blew up in his lap last week is calling the attack an attack on the judiciary. The judge, however, refused to answer questions about the ongoing investigation. Officials say last week's bomb attack is not related to the others this month. A woman has been jailed in Tucson, Arizona, to make sure she testifies against a man accused of raping her last June. Patty Urias, a member station KNAU, reports from Tucson.
The 24-year-old rape victim has been jailed on a $5,000 bond. Pima County Superior Court Judge Howard Hampman ordered such measures because the woman, a resident of Tucson, missed the first scheduled rape trial and also missed her arraignment on an unrelated drug charge. Deputy County Attorney Eric Larson says this is the first time he's had to request such action of the judge.
It is an extremely rare instance for a victim in any case to be held as a material witness, and certainly in a sexual assault case, it is that much rarer.
The victim, who's been held as a material witness, is also being considered the key witness in the state's case against a 28-year-old Tucson man. Stanley Welch is charged with burglary, kidnapping, attempted sexual assault, and aggravated assault. For National Public Radio, I'm Patty Urias reporting.
A huge fire from a ruptured gas pipeline in New York's heavily populated Bureau of the Bronx sent flames shooting hundreds of feet into the air today. The fire cut electricity to thousands of homes and brought chaos to the city's transportation system. Almost 300 firemen were needed to bring the blaze under control. At least one person was killed in the blast and seven others were injured. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is the final program in our end-of-the-decade series of interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. There was a comedy boom in the 80s, and today we'll hear from some of the people who made us laugh. Before we meet Richard Lewis, one of the comics who made it in the 80s, we have an interview with a comic from an earlier era who continued to perform through the decade. She was one of the first and only female comic headliners of her generation. And although I don't think Phyllis Diller's fang jokes necessarily influenced today's comedy, she did help pave the way for the women comics who recently emerged. Phyllis Diller got a late start in show business. She was a 37-year-old mother of three when she first performed. In her 35-year career, she's always used the persona of a crazed housewife. We spoke in 1986, and she told me what her routine was like when she was starting out.
It was very different because I had no idea what I was doing. Therefore, I was terribly different. There were no female comics around. I was it. I didn't know that. But I had no precedent. I had never seen anything excepting what I had seen on the early days of television in black and white, like Milton Berle, Maury Amsterdam, Art Carney, all men. And there they were. And so I was drawing on my background, my educational background. I did the spoof of a concert. A classical concert. I started with Handel, went through German Lieder, and I did the German, and then I did phony captions, you see. I did a parody of Amahl and the Night Visitors by Giancarlo Minotti, and in my version, her son had lost all his marbles. I did Ima Sumac. At that time, I had a very high voice. And my drum was an oatmeal box, and I had a band on my head with baby shoes and bottle caps. It was madness. I didn't have any idea. I made fun of current high fashion. And finally, little by little by little, I got material. Little by little. I used to read Dear Abby columns and change a few words to make them silly.
How did you start telling stories about Fang, the husband that you use in your routines?
That was an ad lib. I remember in The Purple Onion when I was searching for material, trying out new things every night, and I had a bit about having had an accident in the car, his car, of course, and how I was calling home after the accident to tell old Fang Face. Because the minute you're in trouble, he's the heavy. And I worked on it and realized that I was onto something because this idiot that I portray on stage has to have a husband. And he's got to be even more idiotic than I.
All of the men comics of the period were telling wife jokes. Was this your answer to wife jokes, to do husband jokes about Fang?
Not consciously. It's just that you do on stage whatever is going to get laughs. I was just simply testing, trying everything out. I didn't do anything consciously. I just wanted laughs, that's all.
Did people assume that Fang really was your husband, that you had this, like, absolutely crazy husband?
Well, they still do. Every time I'm seen with a man, they say, "Are you Fang?" Everybody wants to meet Fang. Everybody wants to see Fang. Everybody is interested in Fang. They love him. I've built a monster.
How did your husband feel knowing that people would assume that he was Fang?
My first husband adored the idea of being known as Fang. He loved it. He had stationery made up with nothing but Fang on it. And he liked it very, very much. I guess it gave him some sort of importance, which he enjoyed.
Well, let's talk about the character you invented for yourself.
Oh, how about
her? On stage, yeah. Okay, describe the way you will typically come out for a performance.
Like a maniac. Dressed silly, with silly hair, funny little boots, little gloves. All clowns wear gloves, even Mickey Mouse. And I wear gloves, the little teeny short gloves, and a little short dress, and that's it. It's a funny persona. And this woman is an idiot, you know. She's a harridan. She comes out. She's telling everybody what's wrong with everything, you know. Please.
So you designed your own image. You designed your own clothes, too. Did you decide what to wear on stage?
Well, you see, I used to dress pretty square, pretty straight. The first few years, I wore actual... One year, I wore Chanel suits. Another year, I wore a Balmain suit. And they were satin and shiny. And I realized I had to wear something shapeless or I couldn't make jokes about my body.
Because your body was too nice?
That's right. I hate to tell you that. So then I invented shapelessness. And to this day, I wear shapeless things so that I can tell them anything I want about my body.
What was your self-image like then? Because you'd get on stage and talk about how ugly you were and how, you know, your husband wouldn't come near you and all these jokes about that. And in fact, you probably had a terrific figure. You're probably, you know, a good-looking woman, but you'd made yourself into a crazy woman for the performance. So what was your self-image like deep down inside?
I was so busy carving out a career that I didn't have much of a problem with it. I mean, I wasn't a beauty. I was never a beauty. A beauty is sort of a way of life. A beauty is sort of the way you act. Beauties are soft and they talk a certain way. Beauties don't talk like I talk. You know, I'm into the nitty-gritty. I'm into editing. See, my mother, when the phone rang, she picked it up and said, "State your business." So you see, I was not brought up to be a beauty.
In your routines, you do pretty rapid fire.
Well, 12 laughs a minute is as fast as anyone can talk.
How do you build it up? Is there a model that you have about how jokes should build and when the capper should come on?
Oh yes, the final word must be the joke word, must be the operative word. The final word should end in an explosive consonant, like pop, or puck, or kook. You understand? There are mellifluous words. Mellifluous is one of them. It flows. It's pretty, you know. It's one of those lovely words, like lavender. You want something strong and pop at the end, like a shot. For years and years and years, people likened my delivery to machine gun fire.
Is there a rule of thumb you use about how many you can tell in a row like that before changing the subject?
Yes.
A sense of rhythm about that?
You find that out by doing them. You have a whole. You want to do as many as you can on one subject because you see it's economy. You have one setup, and then all the tag. You don't have to repeat the setup because every time you do a tag, it has to have a setup. But if you can have one setup and then as many as possible lines, but there is a limit to how many they will take on one character.
Can you give an example of the setup and a few tags?
Well, she's so fat that. That's your setup. And then you got all these tags, like sa-da-ba-da-dum, ba-da-da-doom, di-doom-doom-doom-doom. It's music.
You always strike me as being the forerunner of say, Joan Rivers, you know, that like one of Joan Rivers' models, for a few reasons. First of all, because you're two of the few women who've made it to your stature in the world of comedy, but also because of your self-deprecating kind of humor, which she really has gotten into. Do you see any connection? Do you know her well?
Yes, she's my dear friend, and I don't know any other way for a female comic to get on. You have to beef about something because comedy is tragedy revisited. That's my definition of comedy. People say, what is comedy? Okay, if you come out and you're lovely and there's no comedy. So self-deprecation and denigration is par for the course. Works.
Do you think it's different for women than for men? Do you think that women more so have to have that kind of humor?
They need a little more help than men do because there's a double standard. Men can talk raunchy without being pilloried. Women are it's the Madonna complex, the Madonna syndrome. They're the mothers, the softies. And when a woman is going to be hard enough and aggressive enough to do comedy, she better have some saving graces. Like, look, I'm humble. I don't think I'm pretty.
Did you have to do that? I mean, do you feel like you had to do that to get in or something?
No. Uh-huh. Remember, I didn't know anything about what I was
right,
doing.
Right, okay.
Look, if I hear a laugh, it stays in. It's very simple. Like, if the bucket doesn't leak, don't repair it.
You recently had plastic surgery. Well, several times.
All the time.
All the time? what have you had?
Oh, have you got an hour? I've had everything. I've had 3 facelifts. The latest thing, I had that eyeliner put on, permanent tattoo. I had a chemical peel. I had a breast reduction. I had a tummy tuck. There's only one procedure I haven't had, and that's liposuction surgery or lipectomy, where they use a vacuum thing that was invented in Paris to suck out unwanted fat from places on your body where exercise doesn't affect.
Why did you have all the plastic surgery?
I was ugly and beginning to look old.
Mm-hmm. Well,
old and wrinkled and hangy.
Uh-huh.
We're talking droop. Droop city.
It's interesting because you'd made your career on being crazy looking, on putting yourself down, on being the frumpy housewife.
True.
So now, I mean, you have... You look rather glamorous.
I hope so. But you see, I'm a single woman and I have a private life. My private life is very important to me. Very important. That's my real life. My life on stage is not real. I am a person. I am real. And I want to look good.
If you had the perfect nose and lips and breasts and everything when you were getting started, do you think you would have gone into comedy?
Well, I did have the perfect breasts, the perfect figure, and my nose was crooked. Let me think. My teeth were crooked. Well, comedy is within. It has nothing to do with your appearance. My appearance helped because it was dysplastic. It helped. And then I made it help more by getting crazier and learning to be theatrical and things like that.
So you have 2 personas, as you always did, one offstage and one onstage. And how are you dressing on stage now?
Crazy. But chic. I mean, it's satire of what is chic right now. That's the way I dress.
Are you still talking about Fang?
Oh, honey, he's so big in my act. He's one of my big numbers.
Did you like wife jokes when how do you feel about them now?
I think they're wonderful. I love jokes. I love comedy. I worked with male comics who said, you've heard this is a classic because... More than one comic I've heard say it is where he's married to the woman who's so neat, you know, so neat. She's always, everything has to be perfect. You know, men don't like that. The joke that I loved when he got up to go to the toilet one night, came back, the bed was made. Have you heard that joke?
No.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Can't you see this compulsive woman?
Yeah,
making this man's life miserable.
The problem I've always had with wife jokes is that they always seem to be about the whole genre of women. It's because they were never spouse jokes, because until you came along, there were no women telling jokes. So the joke was always on the woman and never on the man. So instead of being jokes about married life or having this lifelong companion, it was always jokes about women, jokes about dames. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it seemed to put down the whole gender instead of... You know, talking about the tribulations of a long-lasting relationship that men or women would have. Do you know
True.
What I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. But I did some good work, didn't I?
Yes.
I almost have a cause.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been such fun, Terry. I really love your show.
Thanks. Thanks for being here. Comic Phyllis Diller coming up, an interview with comic Richard Lewis.
I mean, I don't mind being with the family on Hanukkah, because being on the road, like I was in the Deep South about 2 years ago on Hanukkah, they thought Hanukkah was a duck call. That's all I know. It's like, Hanukkah, pull, shoot. That's all, you know. I tiptoed around the Deep South on Hanukkah. I just want a sandwich. I'll be fine. Just let me have a sandwich. But Hanukkah, Christmas, we didn't know what we were, quite frankly. We're sort of a, I really don't know what we were. We had like a, there was a Christmas tree, and yet... Yeah, it was a Hanukkah bush. It was sort of like a sort of like an elephant man kind of thing there. It was like they had balls hanging down, and yet there was like a picture of gold in my ear sort of over here. It wasn't Hanukkah, it wasn't Christmas. It was Chronica. We had Chronica.
Fresh Air's End of the Decade series of interviews from the archives continues after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
After years of doing stand-up, Richard Lewis ended the decade co-starring with Jamie Lee Curtis in the sitcom Anything But Love. The neurotic magazine writer he plays on the show isn't far from Lewis's neurotic stage persona. Our interview was recorded in 1988, just after the completion of his HBO comedy special, I'm Exhausted.
Thank you. You're a great audience. I wish I could feel better about feeling good, quite frankly. I'm a hypochondriac. My grandparents, they lived in a place that made me so out of it in Florida. I think the condo was called Crestfallen. That was the name of it, you know. So I feel, you know, and they bought me little gifts. I mean, well, they were very negative. We had like a little depression fair in the backyard for my birthday, and we used to throw wooden hoops around. Prescription drugs was a big thing. And they had no Tomorrowland, which is sort of a big thing. And pin the blame on the donkey was a major game in my house.
How did the I'm Exhausted show come about? Do you go around saying to friends all the time, oh, God, I'm exhausted?
I said that, actually, I think, to my mother moments after I was born. I just have always been exhausted for the fear that I wouldn't do enough work. That's a whole other area, isn't it? Now, I don't always go around saying I'm exhausted. I'm a good friend. If I went to a funeral, I wouldn't be insensitive and say, I'm exhausted. I had been exhausted prior to doing this special for HBO. But the problem was the special had to be done in about 2 weeks. And that was like, this should have been an episode of Nova, you know. how a Jewish man with bad posture who searches for perfection is told by executives that, fine, but we have to have it delivered in 2 weeks. And, you know, we pulled it off, I think. I don't know. But I was exhausted doing it, and I think it shows. But in a positive, affectionate way.
When do you allow yourself to take some time off? Here's what I'm thinking of. I know I'm the kind of person who, in order to take a day off, I have to have something measurable, like a temperature. You know, like, right. If I have a fever, fine, you stay home. Are you like that? I mean, do you need to have something really tangible, a real tangible problem in order to actually get some rest?
I need, basically, I get rest after a breakup from a relationship. I usually then feel I reward myself. I usually go away for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
Without sounding, you know, tongue-in-cheek here too much. I mean, I really put a lot into relationships, and when they don't pan out, I then take a rest. I also, when I get the flu, God forbid, but when I do, it's like everything stops. I pull the phones out of my house. I don't care. I have absolutely no responsibility to anyone. I don't go to surprise parties. I'm in the bed. I'm in the bed for as long as it takes. I just feel as nauseated as I am, it's the only time I really relax.
Did you enjoy being sick when you were a kid?
Well, I did because I usually wasn't, but people did. It was like a hypochondriacal kabuki theater I put on for the family, and I had different makeups for different ailments, of course. The flu, I felt, was the dead giveaway. I mean, it was this kabuki, very white makeup, and it was almost a mask-like effect, and it was frightening. I was half a bison, half a Jewish man, and I come down to breakfast knowing that my family would shriek and then have me stay home, and they normally did.
Are you a hypochondriac now?
Yes, sadly.
What are the diseases you most often think you're getting?
Well, I would say mostly, and not to make light of diseases because they're so horrific, and certainly the sexual stuff now is so frightening. I basically get worried when I see any kind of rash. Even if the slightest rash, I feel it will eventually spread into just cover me like Elephant Man. And I run to every salve store. There's a lot of salve boutiques in Los Angeles, thank God. And I have a rash man in Beverly Hills who I like. But basically, it's rashes that scare me more than anything. And also, any kind of back pain, I always fear, and I always did as a kid, sadly, whenever I got a sore throat, for example, I really felt it would never go away. This was when I should have known then that psychotherapy was right around the corner.
Do you ever have audiences who are so well adjusted that they don't get your jokes about neuroses?
I don't like to consider any audience well adjusted. Seriously, I don't like to judge people, and I certainly wouldn't judge people in that light. I don't find too many people are well-adjusted, and if there were, I wouldn't go over very well. If I ever bomb, thank God I don't bomb as much as you do when you start out, I would I would just blame myself.
You've done the David Letterman show a lot of times. How many times do you keep count?
I thought it was somewhere in the high 30s. You know.
Do you prepare for it when you go on?
In unbelievable fashion. It's the only reason why I have done stand up in the last 6 years, or given me impetus to do it, and because I never had an audience before, like on a regular basis. So I write down thousands and thousands of jokes a month. It takes me days and days to whittle it down to 30 or 40 ideas that I want to get to the show. Not to mention we ad lib a lot on the show too, but I prepare in an enormous fashion for the show.
And I feel I had a problem sexually. I felt, ever since I grew up, I just, and we broke up, she was saying that she's bad-mouthing me to my pals.
Oh, is that
she
right?
Said, I gave her an anti-climax, she was telling my friends. And I couldn't even...
That could be dangerous,
we couldn't even have
it?
Foreplay. She wore like a Rupix bra when she came into the bedroom. And I blame my family. My parents, I know they made love, and yet it was like Nixon, like Watergate. They would cover it up.
Very, very, quiet.
Well, they,
about
they,
it,
they didn't want to let us hear that they were screaming. Yeah. My father would go, that's gin. He would say, that's gin.
Doesn't Letterman strike you as a pretty healthy, well-adjusted guy?
I wouldn't go that far. Again, I hate to judge people's good health. I'll say this. I think so. I mean, we're so night and day together. I mean, why I think the chemistry has been effective for him and me. When I sit next to him, and I talk about my innermost feelings and certainly sexuality, I look in his face. He's only a foot away from me, and it makes me laugh because I'm not doing this to make him embarrassed, but he does get, I feel, legitimately embarrassed, and it's cute to me. But his eyes start to recede. They go back like to the Panama Canal. I can't even see his face. It's like a little off in Annie's eyes.
Can I ask you what your bar mitzvah was like? And here's why I ask it. For a lot, I mean, a bar mitzvah is, in Jewish terms, it's a religious ceremony to mark the beginning of manhood. It's just, but for a lot of people, it's like their first opening act, you know, like the first initiation into show business. Because, like, you're the star of the show. There's a band. There's an MC. You know, everybody in your family gets to dance and everything. And you're the star. Was it like a... what kind of bar mitzvah did you have?
Spielberg could not have done justice to what I had. First of all, my father, who has passed on, was the greatest caterer in the area, New Jersey and in parts of New York. He was really a genius. So, of course, he catered my bar mitzvah. It got off on a low self-esteem note that my father was booked up on the weekend for my bar mitzvah. I had to settle for a Tuesday afternoon.
Are you kidding?
Early evening bar mitzvah party. Unheralded in the Torah. I mean, I heard Moses grumbling, how can he do that to his son? Rah! But what happened was, I understood, you know, he had a job to do, and Tuesday night was sort of hip, now that I think of it. But before the party, I had to, the Saturday before, I had to read what they call the Haftorah, or Haftorah. I'm very bad with the accents here. But, what happened was that I started screwing up a little bit, and I saw some of the congregation getting a little uneasy, and then I started doing stand-up. I went, I'm kidding, Jonah and the Whale, come on. And I started playing the temple like a lounge.
Comic Richard Lewis on this final edition of our end-of-the-decade series of interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. You can see Richard Lewis in the sitcom Anything But Love. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, three comics as we conclude our series of interviews from the Fresh Air archives. Richard Belzer explains why, no matter what your religion or ethnic background, if you live long enough, you'll be Jewish. Also, writer and director Robert Townsend talks about creating comedy from racism in his movie Hollywood Shuffle. And comedian Al Franken tells us how he created the Al Franken decade. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The new president of Czechoslovakia is Václav Havel. Havel, a former dissident and banned playwright, will serve until free elections are held this summer. NPR's Deborah Amos has more on the story.
President Václav Havel faced his supporters from the balcony of Prague's medieval castle today. "It has happened," they shouted in unison. Havel said there would be free elections this summer. His election today was a milestone in a movement that has unseated the hardline communist government of Czechoslovakia in a matter of weeks. Havel has spent almost 5 years in jail for his political activities. His plays were banned until a few weeks ago. He's considered a moral authority by his supporters in the same mold as Thomas Masaryk, the president of Czechoslovakia's first republic. Masaryk was known as a philosopher president. His flag still flies over the castle. It says, "Truth prevails." In Prague, this is Deborah Amos.
In apparent efforts to smooth troubled waters with the Vatican, the White House today said that the Catholic Church is doing a fine job in its efforts over the fate of Manuel Noriega. A Bush administration spokesman also said that talks with church officials continue in a positive vein and that no deadline has been set for solving the deadlock over Noriega's presence in the Vatican embassy in Panama City. Presidential Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater brushed aside the Vatican's assertion that it had no obligation to turn over this man to an occupying force and instead praised church officials. The FBI says it is taking seriously new death threats contained in a letter mailed to a television station in Atlanta. The letter also named a group allegedly responsible for the recent pipe bomb murders of a federal judge and a Georgia attorney. Ed Hula reports.
The FBI says the letter contains information that could only be known by someone closely associated with the pipe bombings or by investigators familiar with the case. While anger over school desegregation was at first thought to be a motive for the bombings, the letter says the judge and lawyer were killed to retaliate for the 1988 murder of an Atlanta woman for which two black men were charged. And it goes on to threaten in this direct quote, "Anytime a black man rapes a white woman in Alabama, Florida, or Georgia in the future, Americans for a competent federal judicial system shall assassinate one federal judge, one attorney, and one officer of the NAACP." For National Public Radio, this is Ed Hula in Atlanta.
About 800 miles from Hawaii, a freighter is said to be sinking with 28 men on board. A Chevron tanker has pulled alongside the ship, trying to keep it from going down. The crew on the freighter is said to be out of danger unless the ship should sink rapidly. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 21 points to close at 2,753.20 in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. We're concluding our end-of-the-decade series of interviews from the archives with a comedy show. Along with Eddie Murphy, Spike Lee, and Keenan Ivory Wayans, Robert Townsend is one of the black filmmakers who emerged in the 80s. And like Murphy and Wayans, Townsend got his start doing stand-up. Townsend directed Eddie Murphy's film Raw. And in 1987, Townsend produced, directed, and starred in the comedy Hollywood Shuffle. It's a semi-autobiographical movie about a young black actor who learns that the only parts available to him are black stereotypes.
Anyway, after getting my degree from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, I decided to come to Hollywood and do some movies.
Good. Why don't you start with the speech? That's very interesting.
Sure. Okay. Let me see. "I ain't afraid of you. What is happening with your cool vines?"
Thank you. Thank you.
You're the worst actor I've ever seen in my life. I have to be frank with you.
I could do it in iambic.
"You
be messing with the wrong dude, bro.
Thank you. I got nice. Thank you.
Did you like it?
Very much. I ain't be got no weapon.
When I spoke with Robert Townsend in 1987, his memories of auditioning for the stock black male roles as pimps and junkies were still very fresh.
I didn't know how to speak up at that point because every actor in town was in there auditioning, and I said, wait, this is a terrible script. Maybe it's me. And then I started thinking about it, and I would go in and read a script, and I go, this is terrible. And then the next guy, this is the greatest pimp I've ever read, you know. And I think it had to do with, you know, I began back then to begin to look and see something was wrong.
What kind of roles were you auditioning for that you're talking about?
Stoolies on TV shows, you know, the guys that always have the information that the cops always talk to, Huggy Bear, Turkey Neck, you know, they always have those weird names. So those are the kind of parts I would audition for.
Are you convincing in that kind of role?
I'm a good actor. I could pull it off. Yeah, I mean, I consider myself a good actor. You know, I wouldn't mind doing a street character if I could play a lawyer next week and a doctor the week after that, or a detective like Sam Ace or something like that.
But the problem is there aren't many roles like that to play.
Right. They always write the stereotypical, you know, just jive street.
The character in your movie is directed to be blacker while he's playing a part or auditioning for a part. Were you ever directed to be more black?
Oh, yeah, because, see, the way I talk, when you're considered black, you're supposed to talk like, well, yeah, baby, you know, I'm doing this interview and things with you. So that's the way I should talk. That's considered black. If I was saying like, oh, this is national radio, baby, that's black. But the way I'm talking now, then they say, well, you don't sound black. I mean, you could, you know, if I was just tuning in, I would say, is this a black person? I don't give you the key words. And so a lot of times they ask you to be blacker because black is, you know, all the, you know, sitcoms of the 70s. And they say what? So that's considered black.
You had a lot of actors who you cast in your movie. Did they all have stories similar to yours about being cast in roles they didn't really want in the first place? Roles that were very stereotypical?
Yeah, I mean, everybody. I think one of the reasons the actors agreed to do the film was because they could identify with the movie. It was their story. A lot of actors, older actors, black actors, come up to me now and they say, thank you for telling our story and what we were all going through and is going on now, and, you know, you're told.
Now, you've also been in some TV commercials. For years, there were virtually no black actors in TV commercials, but now, especially in burger commercials and in soft drink commercials, there's a lot of black actors in it. Are there new stereotypes of blacks coming out through these commercials?
No, I think commercials, if anything, they show black people in a better light. I mean, in TV commercials, at least I had dignity in 60 seconds. I mean, I was a bank teller. I was a construction worker. I was a plumber. Just a regular guy hanging out at an office building, you know, waiting on a date. I mean, they have different, you know, commercials at least show life. You'll see a black family on a TV commercial. On TV shows, you never see that. You know, you'll see, like, for McDonald's, you'll see, it's time to go. Our family's on our way to McDonald's. Hey, Dad, you know, and they'll show like a loving family or Tide commercial. They, you know, show a family with a mother and father. Your average show on TV, it's always, I had to raise these kids on my own and I'd never seen they daddy.
What are some of the movies you liked when you were growing up?
Wizard of Oz. My favorite film of all time is Here Comes Mr. Jordan with Robert Montgomery. That was one of my favorite films.
I love that film. That's the film about the boxer who's been reincarnated, basically, sent back
right.
down to Earth.
Yeah, Claude Rains, Robert Montgomery, and Warren Beatty did the updated version with, Buck Henry and James Mason. It's like, Joe, listen, Joe, you're not Pendleton, Joe. You can't stay in this body, Joe. You know, that was one of my favorite films.
As a teenager, did you like any of the exploitation films like Shaft and Superfly?
I love those movies because that was the first time we saw the black man get the girl. You know, I remember seeing the scene in Superfly when he made love in the bathtub, and it was like, I can't believe this. Because other than that, black people had played butlers, and it's like, you want your luggage, Mr. Jenkins? And that was the only role we played. And so when you saw Shaft, and he had a gun, and he slapped people around, and he fought for right, you know, it was like, great. We had never seen it. because normally the black actor was the buddy to the star. He never, you know, like, he never was the man. You know, he never was in charge and said, I'm fighting for right, and that's what I'm going to do here. You guys are bad, you know. And Shaft was that way, and Superfly was that way. I just think that they made more pimp movies than they made movies about, you know, black people from the regular walks of life. I think that's what messed everything up. There were too many negative role models. I mean, if they would have had a pimp movie and then a movie about a doctor, then a movie about a lawyer, and a movie about a guy who was in love, everything would have been fine. But it was just, you know, 90 pimp movies versus one sounder. You know, that was what the deal was.
You started as a comic, I think, before you became an actor, and you do great impressions. Did you do impressions a lot as a kid? Did you do impressions of teachers or movie stars, family?
Yeah, I did a lot of impressions. I used to cheat the phone company. I used to call because I didn't have money. And when I was, you know, going to the basketball court, I would call the fellas, and that's how I used my talents back then. I'd get on the phone and, hello, operator, I'm sorry, I deposited a dime in the telephone. I can't reach this number. Yes, operator, my name is Dr. John Wilson. Yes, thank you for putting me through, operator. Thank you. Yo, Willie, how you doing, man? Yeah, meet me at the gym, 4:30. So I would do different voices and characters.
Why did you go into acting from being a comic?
Well, I wanted to be an actor first. I wanted to be a dramatic actor, and everybody would laugh at me. So I said, I should be a comedian.
Did they really laugh at you?
They really said I would do a dramatic scene, and people would laugh. And I was going, wait a minute, that was dramatic. That was drama. And people go, no, you're funny, man. You're funny. No, that's funny. You know, and I said, let me be a comedian then.
Robert Townsend's movie, Hollywood Shuffle, is out on home video. This is the last day in our series of interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. Coming up, an interview with comic Richard Belzer after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Belzer has often been called a comic's comic. In the early days of Saturday Night Live, he warmed up the audiences before the broadcast started. Then he graduated to appearing on the show as a guest. In the 80s, he was a regular on Alan Thicke's short-lived late-night show. He had his own cable specials and headlined at clubs from coast to coast. I spoke with him 2 years ago. He told me he was thrown out of every school he attended, then kicked out of the Army, too.
I was actually discharged under honorable conditions for being too funny to carry a gun. So wait a minute, this guy's too funny. He's too funny, which is almost true. Actually, I got out of the Army by feigning mental illness, if you will. I pretended that I was suicidal, and I staged this whole thing where I said I got beat up and my back was hurting, and they found out I was faking, and they sent me to the Jewish chaplain in the Army. I didn't know there were Jewish chaplains. I thought Pat O'Brien was the... I didn't know Jews joined the Army. I didn't know Jews were, let alone chaplains. And I went to this rabbi, and I said, Rabbi, because my sergeant said that you got to go see your chaplain, Belzer, because you need help. So I went to the chaplain. I said, Chaplain, with all due respect, I think I need to see a psychiatrist. And he said, you know, Freud was a Jew, and the reason he became a psychiatrist was to discover his Jewishness. You don't need a psychiatrist. You need to discover why you're a Jew. And he lectured me on kosher food and choirs and how I could sing in the Army Jewish choir and eat kosher food. And I said, really, Rabbi, I need to see a psychiatrist. He said, you have to discover. Do you have a girlfriend? I said, no. He said, did you ever have? I said, yeah. Was she Jewish? Good. Like, everything was revolved around Judaism, which was the farthest thing from my mind then. I just wanted to get out of the Army. Finally, I was allowed to go to the psychiatrist, and I, having had a little college, I knew every freshman psychology phobia. So I said that I wet the bed, I was suicidal, I hated my mother, I was afraid of women. I just did every cliche in psychology, and I got out.
That's
amazing. I hope no one's listening.
That's probably
from
one
the
of
Pentagon.
Your, one of your most convincing performances.
Yeah, and I never do this on stage. Maybe I should tell them my Army story on stage.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. There's a lot more. I mean, it's a 40-minute story. I'm really brutally paraphrasing the story.
Well, let me ask you about your life and how you got into comedy. Now, I know you grew up in a housing project.
Yes.
And I've read that you didn't have a lot of money when you were growing up.
No.
And I assume that you were one of the funny kids in the neighborhood. Yeah. Was that a kind of protective shield for you, being funny? Did that mean that you weren't going to be picked on by the toughest kids around?
Well, it's interesting. My wit has saved me more than once. And I found when I was a kid that the tough guys, a lot of the tough guys in the school, liked my wit. So I would hang around with some tough guys, and we would come across some other people, and I would, like, put them down, and they'd go to beat me up, and my friends would beat them up. So I never really had to get in any fights, really, because I would, like, kind of instigate a fight, and then Vinny or Rocco or Vito would do the rest.
Instigate through verbal
yeah,
abuse.
I sound like a little fascist, don't I?
Yes, you
but that's
do.
When I was a little, you know, I was young. It was 30 years ago. I was a young, skinny kid.
Now, you've said in one of your routines that when you were young, your mother used to beat you and that you would try to tell her jokes to get her to stop.
Right, right. Well, she was the toughest audience I ever had.
Yeah.
And my kitchen was the toughest room I ever worked.
Well, how true is that, though?
Actually, it's quite literally true. It didn't work as much as legend has it. But I when I was a kid, I had a crew cut, or a zip, what they called then, very short hair, and I looked just like Jerry Lewis. And I used to do a Jerry Lewis impression. And sometimes my mother would get mad at me, and I'd do my Jerry Lewis shtick, and she'd laugh and forget to hit me. But I'd say that worked maybe 2 times out of 20. So she usually wound up hitting me anyway.
I think the very first time I saw you perform was on Saturday Night Live, and you were doing your impression of Bob Dylan in, like, a retirement center, singing in a Yiddish accent.
Right, well, the 86-year-old Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Now, I hate to ask questions like, sure. How did that idea come to you? But really, how did that idea come to you?
Well, when I was a teenager, and we started first getting into Bob Dylan, and we found out his real name is Zimmerman, and he's a Jew from Minnesota, and this was like a revelation to have a hero that's a Jew. So I said, if his name is Zimmerman, he must have had a bar mitzvah. So I fantasized what Bob Dylan's bar mitzvah must have been like, you know. Baruch atadonai Eloheinu melech olam asher kidshanu b'mitzvosav. And then when he gets older, you know, Oi, once upon a time, you dressed so fine, you threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People called Shediver Dal, you're bound to fall. You thought they was all kidding you. And so on.
Oh, who spoke Yiddish in your family?
Actually, I just got back into Yiddish music. I've discovered these things. Everyone in my family spoke Yiddish, but I resent the fact that they didn't teach me. They didn't teach my brother or my cousins. My parents would talk in Yiddish. My grandparents would talk in Yiddish. And there's a comedian who does a routine. I can't think of who it is, but... where it's true, if I may borrow the routine without crediting the person, and that is that Jewish families had the habit, the adults would tell a joke, they'd be telling a joke in English, and then a kid would walk in the room, and then they do the punchline in Yiddish. They say, so the guy walks up to the maid, he opens the door, he sees that she has no clothes on, and then a kid walks in the room, and he goes, "Achal v'shin v'chel v'cha," and you don't know what the punch... It was the most frustrating thing I've ever... I still resent my uncles to this day for doing that to me. And I wish I could remember the comedian that did that. I guess it was Robert Klein, but that's not my routine, but it's a true story.
You know, since it was the older people in your family who spoke Yiddish, did you think that when you grew up you'd automatically know the language?
That's funny, because I have a theory that everyone, when they get old, no matter what religion they are, they have a Jewish accent. Even Irish people, they get to be past 65. I want to go to the store now, because I'm in the store, good, because I can't, hello. You know, everyone, Italians, everybody, they, for some reason, they get a Jewish accent. Don't ask me why.
Oh, gosh. One of the problems nowadays is that special interests are so fragmented, and there's only a fairly narrow number of things that everybody knows in common, like the records everybody knows, or... the books everybody's read. Do you ever want to say something in one of your routines that you know you can't say because only like 3 people are going to get the joke?
Well, that's one of my jobs. I like to talk about esoteric things. I mean, not 90% of my act, but there are a lot of things in my act over the years that have been things that I've seen or read that is not open to the general public, or literary references, or things about science, or things about all different kinds of subjects that I feel compelled to talk about. And without being patronizing, sometimes I think I can educate the audience And if I mention something that they never heard of, a literary reference or a line from a play or a new scientific discovery, then maybe they'll go and find out about it. So I'm not inhibited. I know a lot of comedians try to be as broad-based and as commercial and as accessible as possible and as least offensive as they can be. And for good or ill, I never subscribe to that theory.
I know that in 84, I think it was, you were diagnosed as having cancer, and you're over that through surgery.
Oh. Oh, my God.
You said in a magazine article that in a way that was a blessing in disguise. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that when you feel the breeze from the wings of death, as I did, the more you feel how mortal you are. All the near-death cliches are true. It does change your life. You do look at things differently. You do value people and events more. And I don't mean to be corny, but it's very true. And I think that I reordered my life as a result of that situation. And I don't recommend you go out and get cancer by any stretch of the imagination, but it's certainly not a totally negative situation. I mean, I was it's kind of hard to talk about. I was devastated by it, but it was also a very revelatory epiphany for me, if I may be Joycean for a second.
Do you think it changed your work as a comedian at all?
People say it has, but I feel I still have the same point of view. I have a very cynical point of view in terms of the world situation, and I think that comes through. I may seem less bitter now on stage, which is, I guess, in quotes, more commercial. But I'll let other people theorize about that.
Are you in stand-up for the long haul, or would you eventually like to get out of it and just go into acting?
James Cagney, somebody once asked James Cagney what he would like to be remembered as, and he said a hoofer, because he was a dancer, and obviously he's one of the greatest actors in the history of film. I like to be remembered as a stand-up comic, or thought of as a stand-up comic, even though I'm very interested in acting in films and doing radio and records and some music things, but I'm basically a stand-up comedian and proud of it.
Comic Richard Belzer. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on this decade's last weekday edition of All Things Considered. Hi, Robert Siegel.
Hello, Terry Gross. We will have an acknowledgement of this being the last weekday edition of the year, but there's a special surprise there that you'll have to stay tuned for. Hope you will.
Okay.
We'll also be hearing news from Czechoslovakia, where Václav Havel, the playwright, longtime dissident, became president today. And also we'll be hearing about the next ambassador to Washington from Czechoslovakia, a very interesting and wonderful woman named Rita Klimova, and talking about people with one foot in the U.S. and one foot in Eastern Europe, which she has. Also a look at Barbara Piasecka-Johnson's plan to buy the Lenin shipyards in Gdańsk.
Thank you, Robert. Happy almost New Year. That and more is coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Any comic who did impressions in the 80s had to do a good Ronald Reagan. Al Franken did what some of us thought was the most convincing impression of another political voice, televangelist Pat Robertson. Al Franken has worked at Saturday Night Live on and off since its inception as a writer, producer, and performer. In our 1988 interview, he told me he started to work up his Robertson impression at the beginning of the decade. During the 1988 presidential primary campaign, Franken played Robertson in the Saturday Night Live debates.
Reverend Robertson, you bristled Monday when Tom Brokaw called you a television evangelist. Why?
Well, Pat, this is a deliberate attempt by the media to belittle me, and I'm just not going to stand for it. I've been so many things besides a religious broadcaster. I'm a businessman. I'm president of the sixth largest cable TV network in the country. I've mowed lawns. I've been a babysitter. I've watched people's homes while they went on vacation. I've been a caddy. I think that the media, by ignoring these other positions I've had and focusing on 25-odd years of my hosting an evangelical show, I think it's just unfair, and it's just religious bigotry.
Part of being in show business is you get to wake up late. And I used to wake up late and turn on TV, and I'd get the PTL Club and I'd get the 700 Club. So I used to watch them, and one day Jim Baker said something that sort of locked me into his character and also Pat Robertson's character, which is the happy evangelist. Jim Baker said, we had a party last Friday, and when it comes to getting down, nobody gets down like we Christians. And I said, that's a character. But Pat Robertson also does a thing where, because he's always happy, but sometimes he almost sounds like Barney Fife when he gets very happy.
Yeah, you really get this perpetual TV smile on his face and in his voice when you do him. During the first show this season that I saw you on Saturday Night Live, you had revived the Al Franken decade.
Yeah.
How did you first come up with it?
Oh, the Al Franken decade. Okay, basically what happened was in 1979, at the end of 1979, remember the 70s was the me decade, and everybody was sort of saying, well, the me decade's over, what's the next decade going to be about? And there'd be some guy who would write a thing, My Turn, in Newsweek, and he'd say, this is going to be the pull-together generation revolving around how we use our energy resources. And then at the bottom would say, Ted Hudnut is an energy resource consultant. And I realized that everybody was saying basically that the 70s was the me decade, but the 80s is going to be about this thing that I'm involved with. So I figured I'd just make it the Al Franken decade.
And who knows what self-serving tag we'll come up with for the 90s. That was Al Franken concluding our end of the decade series of interviews from the archives. Best wishes for a healthy and happy new year from all of us at Fresh Air, from senior producer Danny Miller, producers Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, director Chris Bergen, production assistants Roberta Sharrock, Joan Tuohy, and Karen Impala, research assistant Sue Spolin, engineers Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, Ron Barron, Don Lachlan, and Bob Balls, Fresh Air alumni Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton, and me, Terry Gross. Our best to you for the 90s.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the best rock albums and the best movies of the 80s with critics Ken Tucker and Stephen Schiff. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the first new shows of the 90s. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.